Getting back to our origin of We the People. Tackling current issues, both political and legal, with common sense. As We the People, we must bring common sense back to make our lives better. Only on Now Media TV.
Good evening, and welcome to We the People, where truth still matters, facts still count, and courage is still required to confront both. I'm Alina Gonzalez-Dockery, attorney, speaker, and unapologetic advocate for a country that works for the people, not just for the powerful. Each week, we expose the fault lines beneath the headlines, and tonight, we're drilling into a case that refuses to fade, not because of conspiracy, but because of unanswered questions, political hypocrisy, and deep public mistrust. I'm talking about the Epstein files. Yes, again. And now there's a fracture, not between left and right, but between Donald Trump and some of his most loyal supporters, MAGA. And a very rude awakening to Donald Trump that he is not MAGA, but that MAGA has become bigger than the man. What happened? Why now? And is anyone actually telling the truth about the client list, the sealed names, and what the law allows to be revealed? So let's get into it. Jeffrey Epstein died in 2019. Officially, it was ruled a suicide. But from the moment the news broke, the public reaction wasn't grief. It was suspicion. Because here's what we know. Cameras malfunctioned. Guards disappeared. His cellmate was transferred out hours before that fateful suicide death. And he had just been denied bail and faced life in prison. So no, the public didn't accept it. And honestly, as a lawyer, I get it. Now in 2025, with fresh pressure mounting, the Department of Justice released a sweeping memo. After reviewing more than 300 gigabytes of evidence, they declared there is no incriminating client list, no grounds to charge any third parties, and no basis to release further files. And yes, they reaffirmed Epstein died of a suicide. But here's where things took a nasty turn, especially for Pam Bondi, our U.S. Attorney General. President Trump, who had once promised full disclosure, this was a big part of the political campaign and also a big part of influencers and podcasters' push for reelecting Trump. He is now calling it a hoax. In a fiery Truth Social post, President Trump wrote, "My past supporters have bought into this bull, hook, line, and sinker. I don't want their support anymore." That's a bold rebuke, especially for a man whose political identity is rooted in exposing elite corruption. So let's get this straight. Yes, Trump was friendly with Epstein back in the past, as we're showing you, as a much younger pre-orange man himself. And this comes right as Trump is defending controversial moves abroad, airstrikes in Iran, weapons to Ukraine, diplomatic deals. Meanwhile, Americans back home are asking, why does the DOJ seem more interested in burying Epstein's files than exposing what he did and with whom? And ironically, you're having like this extreme right on MAGA with an extreme left. Extreme leftists are now all kind of joining within, saying there's a conspiracy to keep us in the dark. But is there really? Or has this just been blown out of proportion once again? And let's face it, just like the JFK assassination trials, those that are in conspiracies, those that believe the hype, are never going to be satisfied regardless of what the files show. Members of Congress, including Representatives Marjorie Taylor Greene, Thomas Massie, are now pushing a discharge petition to force a full release of the sealed document. Even Democrats like Ro Khanna are signing on. But here is the reality. the defense attorneys for Epstein have all stated that there is no client list, even for Maxwell. Ghislaine, who is sitting, rotting away in federal prison. Because trust me, if there were a client list, you don't think they would have used that for bargaining with DOJ to get lesser included offenses, lesser prison time? Absolutely. But there is a redacted list of names, and that is because it has been sealed by not one, but two justices. Two federal judges have sealed court records and redacted those court records to remove from public view and from public record the names of the accusers. Because remember, these are the accusers are the alleged victims of rape, sexual assault, and some were minors. And absolutely, we have to maintain that. We have to be able to continue to create a system where victims feel that they can come forward, voice and name accusers without retribution of their names being released. And again, the sealed information is court ordered. Now, as far as those that were accused, those accused that were investigated and probable cause was not found to bring charges against them, those are also sealed by court order. Not one court order, two court orders, sealing and redacting those records. And why is that? That's right. In the United States, in our criminal justice system, we are innocent until proven guilty. It is not on the onus of the accused to prove their innocence. The onus and the burden is on the prosecution. This is critical. So this isn't just about classified files. It's about judicial sealing to shield the identities of accusers and those never charged after a full investigation. In fact, Alan Dershowitz, Epstein's former attorney, said it plainly in the Wall Street Journal. There's no list. The FBI knows the names of the people accused, but that information is sealed by courts, not hidden by the government. And guess what? They are prevented from releasing those names without an order by the court. So again, let me be clear. The courts are the gatekeepers, not the White House, not Pam Bundy, not the Department of Justice. And there's a legal reason for that. You cannot publicly name someone based on uncharged allegations without due process. And also it opens up a huge can of worms of potential defamatory lawsuits, also blackmail. I mean, it's, didn't we just hear all last year that MAGA was saying it wasn't fair and just that Trump was being dragged through the mud? But then there's also a moral question. When over 1,000 victims have come forward, when Ms. Maxwell is sitting in prison, and when Americans are still asking who else was involved, isn't it time for full transparency? So where did this believe in the list come from? From viral videos, from influencers, from headlines that made promises they couldn't keep. Even for former law enforcement officers who fueled stories that facts could never fully support. And yes, absolutely, Pam Bundy, she got wrapped up in that hyperbole and she was using probably more hyperbolic language rather than just stating that we're reviewing the file. So when she said it is on my desk, she did not mean the proverbial client list, she meant the file is on her desk. And yes, after much time and also getting files and boxes of files released from the FBI's offices in New York, they ran through it. When you had the likes of Laura Loomer, who for whatever reason still has some connections and influence with President Trump, when she's saying, making these outrageous claims, and then the media jumps on it. I mean, we have to look at this. We have to ask. And we also have to demand, where are our representatives and why aren't they coming forward and filing the proper petitions with the court? Yes, absolutely. Donald J. Trump was once friends with Epstein. Yes, he partied with him. Yes, he was in, you know, had him at Mar-a-Lago way back when. I mean, look at the hair on the head of this man. There is no question about it. There's no denying. And let's, for those people on the left, the extreme left, trust me when I say if Donald J. Trump were on some list, if any major MAGA or Republican were on that list, that would have been released back in 2016 when the Epstein trials were first beginning. There is no list. But what could happen is potentially, maybe, a potential for bipartisanship to come forward. Because what we're seeing is Hakeem Jeffries just furthering this very misaligned argument and rhetoric. Donald Trump is preventing this. Pam Bundy's wrong. And then also to have, you know, Dan Bongino hurling insults and threats against Pam Bundy. So in our next segment, we're going to examine exactly that, how voices like Dan Bongino helped shape the public narrative before becoming assistant director of the FBI. We'll also ask why the media and this administration aren't doing more to unseal these court records, not to protect the powerful, but to deliver justice to victims. We the people will be right back after this. Welcome back to We the People. In our last segment, we exposed how the Epstein case has split President Trump from parts of his base, his beloved MAGA, igniting a bipartisan push in Congress and triggering new calls for full transparency. But here's the question that still lingers. If the Department of Justice says there's no client list and the court sealed the records, then why do so many Americans believe that a massive cover-up is still unfolding? We're peeling back that second layer of this scandal tonight. Not just what the government says, but how influencers, podcasters, so-called entertainers, and former law enforcement insiders have shaped the narrative, and sometimes at the expense of the truth that we are seeking. So let's start with the obvious. The Epstein story was never just about the facts. It became internet fuel. It was nuclear. Influencers, many with massive followings, took the reins after Epstein's death. They filled in the blanks. And when the facts got murky, they leaned into speculation. And one of the loudest voices, Dan Bongino himself. Yes. Remember, before he became assistant FBI director, he was a podcaster. So who is Dan? A former Secret Service agent, conservative firebrand, and media figure with millions of listeners. Before taking his post as assistant director of the FBI, Bongino was one of the most vocal critics of the Epstein investigation. He regularly suggested, with confident, repeated rhetoric, that the DOJ and intelligence agencies were protecting powerful elites, and they were committing a fraud upon the public. That messaging hit a nerve. It built public momentum, even when the evidence wasn't there. It never was. And let's be honest, it wasn't just Bongino. The podcast circuit, viral YouTube videos, countless X accounts turned Epstein's death into a genre of its own. Yes, that attention pushed the issue into the spotlight, but it also built public expectations that the law could never meet. I'm going to tell you right now, Pam, you were doomed from the get-go. Because here's the legal reality. No influencer, no politician, and no podcast can override what a federal judge has sealed. Not unless the media, the administration, our leaders, hell, minority leader Hakeem Jeffries, petitions the court and demands that the court acts in unsealing these names. Of course, the victims' names have to be kept secret, but how about those of the accused? But then you have to remember, this is a slippery slope because you're opening up for conjecture and potential defamatory remarks. So let's talk about what's real. Again, Alan Dershowitz, Epstein's own former attorney, recently confirmed there was no organized client list. There was never a list. If there were, they would have used it as a bargaining chip. Yes, there were names. And yes, some individuals were accused during FBI interviews, but those names were never formally charged. There was not enough of a basis to charge those accused. And as a result, the accused lawyers requested that those names be sealed, that those court records be sealed and redacted. And why? Because in this country, uncharged allegations don't make you guilty. And if we start exposing names based on accusations alone, we throw out due process entirely. And guess what? Dan knew that. But he was a podcaster. So when are we going to start holding podcasters maybe to a higher degree of accountability? Because this is accountability. Because you see, podcasters are seen as entertainment. They're not seen as actual news sources. And you could say the same about me. But there should be some accountability. And I find it highly laughable that Dan Bongino, assistant director of FBI, started blasting Pam Bundy, our U.S. Attorney General, when he was the one who fueled all of this speculation. He was the one who gave the biggest amount of gas on a freaking conspiracy bonfire. At the same time, the DOJ admits that over 1,000 victims were harmed. Over 1,000. It's undeniable there was a trafficking operation. It is undeniable that Epstein is the most vile, disgusting example of rotten evil. These were young ladies. These were young children. But one thing's for certain, and it has been denied up and down, there were no videos. There was no list. And at some point, these conspiracists have to end. But then again, we're still dealing with conspiracy theories from JFK's assassination in 1963. Over 60 years ago. But then who do we look to for accountability? You do have a joint memo signed off by Attorney General of the United States, Pam Bundy, Director of FBI, and the Assistant Director of FBI. And it is even more interesting now. So let's say, yes, our congressional members, this administration, media can all file petitions with the courts in New York, the federal courts of New York, to see if they can get these records unsealed, at least for investigation of who is on the accused. Why aren't they doing that? But what's even more, I would say, worthy to examine further is how the MAGA movement is bigger than Trump. What is now is the realization is when Trump takes something personally, that is when he backlashes. He lashes out, and he's lashing out to his former supporters. Well, That could include Elon. And some are saying a lot of this backlash is because of the whole rift between Trump and Elon. But what it really is stating, just like the woke, progressive, socialist extreme on the left is bigger than Bernie Sanders, is bigger than AOC. See, AOC might be a mascot, a face of that, just like Trump could be seen as kind of like the mascot of MAGA, but he is not MAGA. And now he's starting to get that pushback. With Epstein is dead. Now, really the question is, it's not whether he was murdered. Was there an assisted suicide? Because there are questions. How is it that you had the cameras going on and off, on and off? There's definitely questions as to why the guards left somebody who was on suicide watch. Or could there have been a little assistance saying, here you go, here's your sheets, go ahead, hang yourself. Ghislaine Maxwell is behind bars. Now, she's not speaking. She is not providing any names. Does she have any incentive to do so? No. And I assure you, as a criminal defense attorney, I'm sure those criminal defense attorneys would have used any bargaining chip to either get her a full immunity to turn state's witness or federal witness against the other accused, and also to get zero outcome or a lenient sentence. That did not happen. So let's look at those court seals. They stay. It's court ordered. Nobody has the authority to take those records, unseal them without the court's approval. And I think that's what's not being stated. So here's what I believe as an attorney, a citizen, and a woman. This isn't over, and it shouldn't be. Not if victims are being silenced. Not if public trust is still shattered. Not if the courts, the very system meant to protect justice, are sitting on sealed files that could help Americans understand the truth. But it still has to weigh the equities in balance, harm versus good. So what do we need? A formal petition by the media to the courts demanding a review of sealed to unseal those Epstein records, not to violate victims' privacy, but to reveal who else was protected. Bipartisan leadership. Oh my God, couldn't that be a wonderful thing to see bipartisan leadership from both the administration and Congress to support that petition, not just politicize it, not continue on the road that we hate Trump, everything is evil of Trump, blah, blah, blah. And how about this? Dan, take some accountability about the fact that you were talking out of the side of your mouth when you were a podcaster, and maybe you have to uphold justice again. And there also has to be a reckoning with this influencer class, especially those who built careers on pushing the Epstein narrative to their financial gain. If you drove this outrage, you now have a duty to call for lawful disclosure, not more speculation. Let's be clear. This isn't about revenge. This is about trust. This is about providing the people what they want, but also holding people accountable. And the court has the power right now to restore some of it. Here on We the People, we don't chase conspiracy. We challenge power with facts. We'll keep tracking this Epstein fallout, the legal developments, and what our institutions choose to do next. Because if justice is real, it can't be sealed forever. We're going to be back right after this. Welcome back. We spent tonight digging into one of the most controversial investigations in recent memory, the Epstein case, and the way it exposed tension between public expectation, legal process, and institutional trust. And while the story remains active, another quietly unfolding development deserves our attention. The Supreme Court's use of emergency rulings, particularly in politically sensitive cases involving President Trump, because he is coming out the winner on all of these injunctions and immediate policies that are being tested. There is no conspiracy here. Let me reiterate, there is no conspiracy, but there is a pattern of decisions made quietly with limited explanation at moments that shape the political and legal landscape in real time. So let's talk about what that means, what it doesn't, and why it matters now more than ever. What is the emergency docket? The so-called shadow docket. It isn't a backroom shortcut. It is a legally valid process the Supreme Court uses to handle urgent matters before full review is possible. That can include death penalty stays, emergency injunctions, or procedural questions in high-profile disputes. And we have been witnessing a lot of high-profile disputes. These rulings often come quickly, sometimes without oral argument or full written opinion. And here's the key point. These are not final decisions. They're interim rulings intended to maintain order, not render judgment. The challenge to the public, these rulings often feel cryptic. No clear reasoning, no timeline, and often no certainty about what comes next. And also when it's just dealing with, like, say, procedural aspects or on emergency basis to determine whether a lower court overstepped its jurisdiction or its authority, which it has been found, it doesn't mean that it's a done deal. It means that they're pushing it. You still have the constitutional issues. You still have whatever the arguments are going through the appellate process. But one of the things is for sure is that it may take years before a case gets before the U.S. Supreme Court for full hearings, for full oral arguments. And to some, the damage may have been done, or it seems like what they're fighting against or for is already been stated. So when the court doesn't announce whether it will take a certain case or delays a decision on a pressing constitutional question, it leaves the public guessing. And guesswork in politically charged cases fuels distrust. And let's face it, we've seen that left and right. It's been happening since really 2020, if not before. So to be fair, the judges aren't dodging accountability. The court often waits for lower courts to fully develop the legal record before stepping in. That's how our system is designed. We have a hierarchy of court, the lower court, the appellate court, then the Supreme Court. But as we just saw with the Epstein controversy, where the DOJ said there's nothing more to see, while victims and citizens still had questions, procedural correctness doesn't always satisfy public concern. And the Supreme Court, like any other institution, doesn't operate in a vacuum. Their silence, even when lawful, carries weight. And the public has a right to expect transparency, not immediate answers, but clear process. We can respect judicial independence while still asking for clarity. We can support the rule of law while acknowledging when it feels distant or opaque. Here's where we're landing tonight. Just like the Epstein investigation, the legal battles and the broader constitutional questions relating to all of these executive orders that Trump has been initiating and the changes with the destruction of the Department of Education or ICE's ability to deport individuals to other countries other than their home country are far from over. Again, these are emergency immediate powers. And this is nothing new. It's not something new here in this administration. That it occurred in the Biden administration. It was occurring, like, say, for instance, in the Biden administration with the student loan forgiveness. It is just a continuous fight. Emergency docket decisions are procedural bookmarks. They do not close the door on the issues. They set the stage for what's next. The real fights will play out in the circuit courts, with the appellate courts chiming in, whether it's a partial, then the full appellate court, then full Supreme Court arguments. In public forums where legal pressure, public opinion, and constitutional precedent all intersect. So if you're watching the headlines and wondering, is that it? The answer is no. The judicial system moves slowly, but it does move. And as citizens, it is our job to stay informed, not inflamed. It is too easy, especially in a digital age that we're in, where we are connected 24/7, where we are seeing people, influencers on our phones constantly and going to other sources that may not be as fact-checked as it should be. We need to look into this. Transparency matters, process matters, and trust must be earned. And it doesn't help, and I will call myself out this too, that the media only likes to focus on what are the hot button issues that the Supreme Court has dealt with, rather than looking at or reporting about everything. Because the reality is as much as we like to say, oh, this is the Republican court and the left, no. Yes, we have a liberal justice and we have more conservative justices and we have some that are somewhat in the between, and we've seen that. And what's really what needs to be stated is for the vast majority of those cases brought before the United States Supreme Court, there is consensus, often more often unanimously than not. It's just that the more politicized court hearings, like the overturning of Roe v. Wade, that's what gets our attention. And I think that this is also harkens back to look at the conspiracies. I mean, we can go back and into history, but one thing is for certain, there has to be some type of accountability, but there also has to be transparency. The Supreme Court, the United States Supreme Court is not known to be out there and as vocal or as, let's say, camera forward, if you will. But maybe it needs to. Maybe there needs to be some type of educational form to explain these things. Because now, especially in the digital age, especially now that we have great search engines and people are more willing to look up and go down rabbit holes and think maybe they need to be more transparent as to their processes so it can be better explained, so it can be education. The public needs to be more educated on this. We haven't heard the last of the constitutionality of birthright citizenship. We haven't heard the last of the immigration reforms that are done by the pen. And I'm not talking about auto pen or pen pen, you know? And one thing is for certain, what we're seeing, which we're constantly being harangued with, is what is happening is that we're seeing these fast moving cases that are going from federal circuit court to the U.S. Supreme Court to determine whether an injunction can be nationwide or whether until such time as the full hearing, the full trial process on the constitutionality of dismantling the Department of Education can be heard and dealt with but if it goes to whether or not Trump can move forward with his plans to dismantle it, that was dealt with just now. And also recall that we can't just work on hypotheticals. The court isn't there to say if, you know, rule on something that hypothetically may occur. It just can't do that. As we the people, we believe in facts over fear. and law over noise. And drowning out the noise seems to be getting a little bit more difficult each and every day. So whether we're talking about sealed records, emergency rulings, or political fallout, one truth remains: transparency matters, process matters, and trust must be earned. We'll continue to follow these cases and help you make sense of what the institutions won't always explain. Or maybe we should start demanding that the institutions, bureaucratic, judicial, congressional, and executive branches actually be more transparent, or at least start putting forth, this is the procedures, these are the policies, this is how we deal with them. Love what you're watching? Catch every episode of We the People on Now Media TV, live or on demand. Download the free Roku app and access bold bilingual news and commentary 24/7. We the People will return right after this. Welcome back to We the People. We talked tonight about national justice, the Supreme Court, and the tension between transparency, power, accountability, and hyperbolic conspiracy theories. So now let's bring it home a little bit. Let's go to Texas, where the 2026 midterm elections are already taking shape. And it's shaping up to be one of the most interesting cycles we've seen in years, with a three-way political shuffle underway across both parties. Marvalette Hunter enters the race. A new name, who you also want to get to know, Marvalette Hunter. This week, the longtime public servant and policy professional officially announced her candidacy for the Democratic primary for U.S. House in Texas's 38th Congressional District, a seat currently held by Republican Wesley Hunt. Hunter's background is rooted in crisis response, public safety, and community planning. She served as chief of staff to the mayor of Houston and was deeply involved in managing the city's response during Hurricane Harvey and other major events. Her platform emphasizes infrastructure investment, equitable economic growth, and ensuring federal support flows into communities like Houston that drive the Texas economy. And she is a serious contender. Now, she is in the Democratic primary, so she first has to win the Democratic primary. If she wins that, she will presumptively go up against incumbent Wesley Hunt, our current Republican congressional member. But even though he announced back in November 2024 that he was seeking re-election for his seat in 2026, there's something has come up. See, Hunt is eyeing a potential run for the Senate. Why wouldn't he? Because Wesley Hunt is now testing the waters for a U.S. Senate run. And some of you may have seen his latest digital ad campaign there in Dallas. Clear evidence that he's gauging statewide appeal. He's trying to determine, you know, it's basically dipping the toe in the proverbial pool, is the testing the water temperature to see, does if he were to go into this race, which right now there is a contested Republican primary for that Senate position, would he be a viable candidate? And he's doing this before he announces, because if he announces, then he's leaving his congressional seat open. So who is Wesley Hunt? Some of you may have seen him on, well, little reels and on the news. He is a West Point graduate, Army veteran, and a rising GOP voice. Hunt has been a reliable conservative in Congress. But moving into a Senate race would mean entering high stakes primary with national attention and national funding. And that is on a next level altogether. See, the GOP primary is already a little crowded. if you really want to look at who's in there. See, you have our current sitting U.S. Senator, John Cornyn. He's running for re-election. And he is being challenged by no other than Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton. Yes, the same Ken Paxton who has a lot of baggage. Same one that was under investigation and possible impeachment that he was able to overcome just last year, I believe, if not the year before, who's also now going through a very ugly divorce and has his own scandals and of adultery and other such illicit acts that may have caused the breakdown of his marriage. But does that really impact an election, especially nowadays? But it is setting up what could be one of the ugliest and most expensive Republican primaries in Texas and potentially the nation. So let's be clear. Cornyn is a seasoned legislator with established support and deep DC connections. But does that mean he's an insider? Is he one of the swamp? Paxton is coming in with the MAGA base. Yes, he has a lot of legal baggage and a lot of personal drama, but which also includes this messy divorce. But he does have the support of these MAGA base. He had it when he was under impeachment. He was had it when, even though all of the scrutiny was coming out. Now, Cornyn has outraised Paxton in the first quarter, signaling that traditional Republican donors are still aligned with him. But fundraising is really only part of the battle, because if we have seen before, it's not about the amount of dollars that wins elections. You got to have a strong grassroots effort. And let's face it, MAGA has a very strong grassroots effort. And so now you have Hunt, who's testing the waters to see whether he would be a contender. Because right now, it looks as Paxton, according to polls, is outpolling Cornyn. So if Hunt decides to jump in, that really is a disruptor. I mean, we are talking, it is complicating everything. And he could seriously pull off support from suburban conservatives who may want a new face and who may see Hunt as an electable in a general election than Paxton. Because again, Paxton has a ton of baggage. And he may not be as popular throughout the Republican base. And if Hunt does decide to jump in with both feet into the Senate pool, that will then lead wide open his congressional seat. And then it would also see who in the Republicans will try to fill that. But one thing is for sure, for the Texas voters, one thing that is absolutely certain is that the progressives and the Democrats are trying to flip Texas blue. And they have been trying to do that little by little every single election. So the question is this a way to flip another seat blue and get and try to whittle away that very slim margin of a majority from the Republicans back to the Democrats? It also begs the question, are the Democrats really going to start finding out what their identity is other than hate Trump, everything Republicans is bad, and we're just going to be disruptive? Or are you going to actually look at the population? But what does this mean for the Texas voters? Because you all are the ones who are mostly impacted by this election cycle. The 38th congressional district could become one of the most competitive House races in Texas, especially if Marvelette Hunter secures the Democratic nomination and Hunt moves on, because that means we're going to have an unknown. The Senate primary is a proxy war for the soul of the Texas GOP, establishment versus populace, experience versus disruption. Now, Hunt is experienced. Cornyn obviously is experienced. Paxton is seen as the disruptor, because he's seen as the outsider. He's kind of really gotten into that populist movement, and that is his segue. And Texas continues to be a political bellwether, not just for national trends, but for how diverse, growing, and economically critical states navigate power shifts. Voters in Houston and across Texas will be watching closely. We are in July of 2025. The primaries are in, I believe, March of 2026. And then the general election. This is huge. We are going to be focusing more and more on the midterm elections because this is a fight for control. Control of the Senate, control of the House. Will the Republicans be able to garner more wins and hold on to their majority? Will the Senate be able to flip more seats and gain more seats so that they can expand their Republican hold on the Senate? See, these midterms are extremely crucial for the Republicans as well as the Democrats. And voters in Houston, you guys are going to have one heck of a ride. See, we will all be watching Texas very closely because Texas has been in the proverbial tug of war between red and blue, and with blue really trying to flip it ever since Beato. Because in 2026, these aren't just political races. They're defining moments. Defining moments not as to how the country will be led, but also defining moments that maybe, perhaps, I don't know, the Democrats actually grow a pair and define what their policies are, not just go on hate, vitriol, woe is me. Because one thing is for sure, Trump had his thumb on the pulse of the average American voter. And it was economy, hardships. You know, and I've been really kind of looking back at that whole Kennedy era and the Camelot era. And one thing I've noted, especially with Ted Kennedy, in that when he primaried President Carter, it was because he saw that Carter was only putting dourness on the Americans and doom and gloom and not optimism. And then I heard an interview of a college professor who's only 20 some years older than his students, who never knew the hope, the beyond the race, that beyond racism of the Obama administration or even the Clinton. See, I grew up in the 80s and the 90s, and I remember that we had hope and optimism. That was the earmark of Ronald Reagan. And that was one of the biggest things that he pulled from. His Carter was so dour and so pessimistic. And maybe that's what we need. Optimism, hope, bipartisanship. We the people being put first and foremost. So tonight we covered everything from sealed court records to shadow dockets and the early signs of political realignment here in Texas. And if there's one thread running through it all, it's this. Power doesn't move unless people push. Whether it's demanding answers, holding courts to account for clarity, or choosing leaders who understand the weight of public service, we are not the bystanders. The system will always default to its own pace, its own interests, its own protections, unless we, the people, challenge it, not with noise, not with knowledge, with vigilance, and with our votes and our voices. Truth doesn't belong to the loudest of the extremes. It belongs to those who don't let go, and we, the people, won't. I am Alina Gonzalez-Dockery, and I will see you next time.